Good day, and welcome to the University of Minnesota Extension CropCast. I'm your host, Dave Nicolai, with University of Minnesota. I'm a crops educator in Extension. And my co-host today, Dr. Seth Nave, is out of state, actually, at a conference in California. So I'm here with Dr. Bob Cook, and Bob is our extension entomologist here at the University of Minnesota. Bob's primary duties are involving the soybean crop across the state of Minnesota. And the reason we asked you in, Bob, was to talk a little bit about a current subject that's on everybody's mind in soybean production in terms of insects, especially this year in the month of August at this point in time, and that is soybean aphids. So welcome, Bob.
Thanks, Dave.
So this is a good opportunity, Bob, to review a little bit on soybean aphids before we get into the management and economics, et cetera. Can you review for the audience a little bit in terms of the soybean aphids themselves as far as the biology? We've had them around for a number of years. They're not a problem typically every year, but is there anything unique about this last year? We had a mild winter. Some people surmise that that might have an effect. I don't know if there's any way to really pinpoint what may be the actual economic and the environmental situations that are concurred that bring this problem to the forefront for Minnesota soybean producers.
Yeah, I think, you know, after the last couple of years where we did not have much for aphids, and now we have so many aphids around, I think it is good to review a little bit of the basics here. So again, the soybean aphids are these small sap-sucking insects that are attacking soybean right now. And these insects spend the winter as eggs on buckthorn. So they're in the tree lines and wooded areas around our soybean fields. And the winter temperatures are pretty mild. You know, so coming out of the winter, we were assuming we had pretty good survival, pretty good numbers of the soybean aphids making it through the winter. And then in the spring, their eggs will hatch and they'll go through a few generations on the buckthorn plants. And then eventually they'll develop a winged generation that'll fly to soybean. And then once they get on soybean, they'll start reproducing there, and their reproduction is asexual. So they don't need to mate, and they're not laying eggs. They're giving live birth, so giving birth to their little baby aphids. And those baby aphids are actually born pregnant. So they're coming out already with babies inside of them, so they call it telescoping generations. And that's why these insects have such a high reproductive capacity, how their numbers can build up so fast, because, you know, they're not wasting time. They're not waiting for eggs to hatch. They're not waiting to find mates. They're just reproducing right away. And early in the season, I was thinking maybe with all those heavy rains, we were going to take a toll on the populations, because when those aphids are colonizing soybean that's in the small vegetative stages, it doesn't provide much protection for those aphids. So I thought the heavy rains were going to maybe knock their populations down, but that appears not to have happened. We've got plenty of aphids out there.
You know, we talk about reproduction on a fast pace. There's a term that's oftentimes used in talking about soybean aphids, and that's referred to as doubling time. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yep. So, I mean, as the name implies, that's simply just the time that it takes for the population of the soybean aphids to double. So if you went out and scouted your field and you had on average 100 aphids per plant, the doubling time would be how long does it take for that population to get to 200 aphids per plant. And back in the early days of soybean aphid, the early 2000s, Dave Ragsdale here at the University of Minnesota prior to me, his group did some research under laboratory conditions and found that under ideal conditions in a growth chamber with the same super comfortable temperature for the aphids all day long, night and day, they could double their populations in, you know, 2 days or less. But remember, that's ideal conditions all day long, no natural enemies there, no predators eating the aphids, no diseases. So those values don't necessarily translate to field conditions. Under kind of average field conditions, these doubling times have been estimated probably closer to, you know, 5 to 7 days. But, you know, we can get streaks in the summer where temperatures are much more favorable to the aphids, and maybe there aren't as many natural enemies in a field at a given time, and these aphids can double, have doubling times as short as, you know, maybe a few days.
I think the weather records this past summer have indicated that we've had very few days in the 90s.
Right.
Therefore, temperatures, a lot of them the 70s and the 80s and so on. So in that situation, you're not surprised that, you know, we're going to be building up. And especially at this point in time of the year, it seems like from early August to late August is often a prime time.
That's right. You know, that laboratory research from Dave Ragsdale that I mentioned, you know, that was showing that the aphids do not do well when the temperatures are in the, you know, the mid to upper 90s. That really slows down their reproduction, their population growth. But like you said, you know, those temperatures in the upper 70s, low to mid 80s, when we're feeling comfortable, that's when the aphids are comfortable and doing really well. That's when their populations can grow fast.
Now, there's some other environmental things that can affect their population. Do you want to talk a little bit about, from a standpoint of maybe too much moisture or there's disease?
Yeah.
What are some of these other factors that can interfere with their reproduction?
Yeah, you know, I kind of mentioned it earlier, right? So heavy rainfalls, you know, I think in the earlier vegetative stages, those can be more impactful on, you know, like knocking aphids off of plants, drowning aphids. But I think once our soybean plants get bigger, that canopy closes, I think the plants provide more protection where, you know, if you get a big storm, it will probably reduce the aphid population some, but not as impactful as, you know, when we've got the small soybean plants. Another thing that the moisture can do, and especially when we get, you know, streaks of, you know, cooler temperatures, higher humidity, and these are kind of conditions that might favor some of the plant pathogens. Those same kinds of conditions can favor pathogens, diseases that attack the aphids. So there are some fungal diseases that can do a real good job in suppressing or knocking down aphid outbreaks if the weather conditions line up right. And in some of our research plots this year, where we're starting to see the aphid populations decreasing pretty fast, we're seeing some signs of some of these infestation by these fungal diseases.
Now, there's a visual cue here too, isn't there? When you talk about seeing the signs, you can visually see the impact of some of these diseases. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right. You know, so these aphids that are killed off by the fungal diseases they're kind of discolored, you know, almost brownish to kind of reddish, almost kind of color. And they might look a little bit fuzzy as a fungus is growing on them. But as you're out there looking at aphids, you might also see other things. And there are tiny parasitic wasps that can attack the aphids. And when they kill the aphids, they leave behind what we call aphid mummies. And those are essentially just the aphid carcasses, but they take on kind of a characteristic appearance where one group of wasps will leave these black mummies that are kind of the typical aphid size, but they're black and shiny rather than, you know, kind of the bright greenish yellow color of a healthy aphid. And then there's another group of parasitic wasps that will make mummies that are kind of more plump, kind of rounded, and kind of a light tan color.
So in terms of visually looking at it, these are some things that probably a good hand lens obviously would be helpful.
Yeah.
A pair of sharp eyes and in terms of that and, you know, situations with that. You mentioned the parasitic wasp, maybe a little divergence here. For a number of years, and we've looked at control in terms of native wasps and so forth, but also there was some looking at the standpoint of where some of these might have had an origin over in China and other places of bringing wasps into the United States and so forth and releasing. But I think there's been more success with some of the things that have occurred naturally. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right. So Dr. George Heimpel in the entomology department has done a lot of work leading up an effort to evaluate different species of parasitic wasps that attack the soybean aphid in Asia, and then doing research under quarantine conditions where they can safely evaluate if these wasps are going to potentially be effective against the pest, against the soybean aphid. And then at the same time, trying to document that these wasps are not going to have unintended impacts on native species here. So they evaluated numerous different species of wasps and identified some that looked like they would be effective against the pest, against the soybean aphid, and would be unlikely to have these unintended bad consequences. But after doing some of the releases of, I think, two different species, unfortunately, it looks like those species did not establish here. I'm not sure if we know exactly why, but it might be an inability to survive the winters here. But while all that was going on, there is a different species of wasp that made its way over here on its own somehow from Asia, and it's called Aphelinus certus, and it's one that this group of researchers evaluated early on and decided not to examine further because it does attack other aphid species, and they didn't want to be releasing something that could have these other environmental impacts attacking a bunch of different native species. So this Aphelinus certus made its way here. It's spread across the eastern U.S. in soybean, and it's attacking soybean aphid. We see it pretty readily in soybean here, and some people think it's definitely contributing to suppression of soybean aphid.
In addition to the wasp, but there are other natural enemies that are out in the field. Are there some signs and some particular insects, if they are on the increase, to help you determine whether or not, there's a quote aphid food source here?
Yeah, so lady beetles or ladybugs are really important predators of soybean aphids. And early in the season, they can get, if you're walking through your soybean fields and you start seeing ladybugs or lady beetles on the plants, that's a pretty good indication that you've got soybean aphids there. So they can be kind of a scouting tool early on for knowing if you have an infestation. But when you have heavy infestations like you do this year, in the fields that I've been looking at for some of our research, we're seeing tons of these lady beetles out there, right? So that they can, research has shown that they can do a good job, helping to prevent and suppress aphid infestations, but they're clearly not a silver bullet, right? They're out there, but we still have soybean fields reaching damaging levels,
Well, talk about damaging levels for just a second, and keeping those beneficials in mind, how often are we recommending scouting in terms of situations that, I suppose you have a scenario of where you haven't made any applications of insecticides, just the field itself, and versus maybe talk a little bit about scouting after, if you do make an application, how do they compare?
Yeah, I think regular scouting for soybean aphid, ideally, every week, maybe up to every 10 days, something like that. We want to be looking at the fields to, have a feel for what that aphid population is doing. And then using the economic threshold of 250 aphids per plant to make that decision on when to apply the insecticide. And we can maybe talk a little bit more about the thresholds in a little bit. But getting back to the idea of scouting, we want to base our decision to treat a field based on scouting. But after we treat a field or apply an insecticide, we want to get back in that field, after several days, clearly after the reentry interval, but give it some time for that insecticide to hopefully do its job. But we want to get back in there and not just assume that the insecticide did its job, because we know we have resistance to some of the insecticides or that other things can happen with insecticide applications. So we want to make sure that we got the control we wanted out of the insecticide.
And we talk about scouting weekly. Mm-hmm. So if you are trying to get a baseline level of what's going on in a particular field, is that still the best recommendation that we could probably be is to visit that field and to do a thorough job, not, just from the edge of the field?
Yeah, I think so. We want to get out into the field, looking at plants spread throughout the field. And, after treating the field, that scouting is important, not only in case there's a failure due to resistance or something else, but fields can get recolonized. We get into certain times of the year, midsummer, later in the year, when the aphids develop winged generations again, and they can leave certain soybean fields and recolonize others. So we've seen situations where fields get sprayed, you eliminate the aphids that are there, but you might also eliminate all the lady beetles and other predators. And then if you get more aphids or new aphids colonizing that field, those populations can grow very rapidly because there are no predators or natural enemies there to keep their populations in check.
Is there a recommended technique, in terms of scouting methodology here? You want to cover the field, whether it's an M or an X, whatever it might be. But are you going to look in the upper part or the lower part, pull up an individual plant, count it, put it down, and go to the next stop and so forth? But what's a good way to help you in terms of ascertaining whether or not you are at a high level?
Yeah, you know, so for scouting for soybean aphid, it's pretty similar to the recommendations for a lot of different insect pests, right? You want to get good coverage of the field for your scouting, you know, so we might recommend, you know, walking an M shape pattern in the field, and that's just to ensure you get that coverage. You're getting into the field, not just making a decision based on what's going on the edge of the field. And then while you're walking that large M shape pattern through the field, you want to take a look at soybean plants kind of scattered along that pattern. And for soybean aphid, you know, typically we're pulling plants out of the ground, and I like to start at the bottom of the plant and inspecting the stems and leaves, working my way up the plant and kind of tallying up how many aphids I'm seeing on each of those plants, and then probably jotting down those numbers. And when you're done, averaging that up and seeing how that relates to that economic threshold.
So let's dive in and talk about numbers here. The economic threshold numbers, 250 per plant and on 80% of the plants in the field and increasing.
Mm-hmm.
I think you also have to mention about the doubling time in there in terms of that, but making a good observation across there. Is 250 an injury level, or is this going to give you time to get ready and do something?
Yeah, so the whole thing with this threshold of 250 aphids per plant, that's not the point at which the aphids are causing yield loss, not causing measurable yield loss, let alone, you know, not even economic yield loss. That's just that trigger point where once that aphid population gets to 250 aphids per plant, there's a pretty high probability at that point that they're going to continue to increase to more damaging levels of probably, you know, closer to 700 aphids per plant, where the amount of yield loss caused by the aphid infestation at that point is likely to warrant an insecticide application. And
we refer to that as the injury level,
yep,
as opposed to the
economic
threshold.
Injury level. Uh-huh.
Yeah. In terms of that's you.
And then based on those kind of average aphid population growth rates or doubling times that we talked about before, you know, went from that time of hitting 250 aphids per plant to that economic injury level of closer to 700 aphids per plant, or I think it was 680 based on some of the calculations. You know, that would typically give you 5 to 7 days to line up that insecticide application to knock down the infestation so it doesn't continue increasing to that damaging level. However, you know, if you've got those real conducive temperatures for aphid population growth, maybe not many natural enemies out there, that window of time might be a little bit narrower because those populations could be increasing faster and could reach that economic injury level in maybe just a few days.
So don't assume that you have that cushion level of seven
right.
days all of the time.
Right.
A lot of things could factor into that and make that much shorter
mm-hmm.
than it would be otherwise. So you have to be really looking at that field on a regular basis with that. So and I imagine the same thing is going to be true even after if you do choose to make an application of an insecticide, say, for example, you know, one of the things obviously can affect the beneficials, it can affect, you know, the population of the aphids. Do we talk about going back and rechecking and seeing what activity is still in the field?
Yeah, I mean, we touched on this a little bit, Dave, right? You know, after the spray, getting in there to make sure you got the control you were expecting to get from the insecticide. Again, we can't just trust that all these insecticides are going to do their job anymore. We've got resistance to the pyrethroid insecticides. You know, there's chances that these aphids could be developing resistance to other insecticides. So if that insecticide did not work, we want to make sure we catch that. And then if we need to treat a field again, go in with a product from a different insecticide group, right? Like if you were to spray an insecticide from a certain group, you don't want to respray with that same group because that's going to create a lot of pressure for the development of insecticide resistance. We talk about alternating the insecticide groups. And then the other thing, like we mentioned, you know, a little bit ago is, you know, this idea of recolonization. If you're in a time of the year where you got a lot of the winged aphids moving around, you might, you know, do a good job controlling your infestation, but that field could get recolonized by aphids. And this is especially important for the people who are doing some of the early treatments of fields, maybe when they're mixing an insecticide in with a, you know, a herbicide or something like that.
Sure.
You know, we don't recommend doing that, but folks still do it. And when you do that, you might kill off those low numbers of aphids that are out there early in the year. But again, you're also probably killing off the lady beetles and other beneficial insects that are out there. So then when aphid populations start building up elsewhere and you get the winged aphids formed, if they find that field, it's going to be a very favorable location for their populations to develop because they don't have the natural enemies there.
Well, there's a lot of things that can vary. I mean, your neighbor could have a different soybean variety planted at a different time. We're here in mid to late August. We talk about our soybeans getting into what we call the R5 stage, which is the beginning. Mm-hmm. Training to the next stage will be R6, when it'll be a full seed. You know, we have certain things that are going to impact in terms of how long those aphids are going to be economically, you know, infesting a particular field. At some point, you know, they're winged, they're going to leave. And obviously in late fall and or, you know, sometime in September, say, for example, go back to buckthorn or whatever it might be for overwintering. But in a lot of these cases, it's a matter of timing. Just don't assume, you pull the trigger based on activity of the neighbor in terms of that. Every field can be different. Planting can be different. Stages can be different, you know, et cetera, to really go through that.
Yeah, and that's really important this year, Dave, I think. Again, with all the variability in planting dates out there, right? You know, mm-hmm. we've got, you know, fields that were planted late because of all the moisture. And, you know, at this time of year, those are probably going to be more attractive to the aphids. And,
so we're talking about the younger soybeans, you know, the ones in comparison to an older field, if they moved over, you know, that would be greener, so to speak, you know, at a probably maybe an R3 to R4 stage yet at this point in time.
That's right. And I think because of some of that right now, we're seeing kind of a mixed bag out there for population dynamics of soybean aphids. We're seeing some fields where the populations are already starting to decrease. You know, I've got fields where we had, you know, 1,000 aphids per plant in some of the research plots. You know, that was, you know, maybe 2 weeks ago. And, you know, now they're already decreasing. But there are other fields, you know, that I've been seeing and hearing about where populations are lower, but still steadily increasing. So you exactly what you said, Dave, you can't just assume what's going on in one field because of what's happening in other fields nearby.
Yeah, and it can be more impactful in certain things and leave a field for whatever reason. And sometimes it's hard for us to really determine that impact on full seed. You know, the economic thresholds, it's a little harder to make everything mathematically work out because we don't know exactly how long they'll be in that situation and in there. But in terms of scouting, let's talk a little bit about options for treating. If that's your choice, if you're taking the beneficials into consideration in high numbers, there's a lot of things out there on the marketplace. There's single modes of actions. There are things that are mixtures. We had older chemistry, what I call the pyrethroids. And then if you go back even a generation before that, we had chlorpyrifos, which has been in and out of the marketplace from a regulatory standpoint. But, you know, I think in most cases, people are having to make their choices, not so much on chlorpyrifos anymore at this point in time, but maybe more on, you know, single modes of actions, mixtures, pyrethroids. Can you help sort that out a little bit?
Yeah, so if you think about all the different products that are out there and available for soybean aphid, it sure seems like a lot, right? But if you step back and think about those in terms of the insecticide groups that are available, we're really kind of limited. We don't have all that much. You know, we've mainly got, like you said, the organophosphates that have, you know, products like chlorpyrifos. We've got the pyrethroids, and then there's the neonicotinoids, and then a couple other products that are kind of in that same insecticide group. And then there's, you know, the group 9, which is a newer product as well called Safina. So just kind of thinking through this list now, you mentioned chlorpyrifos, you know, so think back to the product like Lorsban, and it's been kind of a regulatory roller coaster for chlorpyrifos, right? Where it was taken away, then we got it back, and then now it's kind of temporary availability. So currently, I think we've got 10 products that can be used for soybean, chlorpyrifos-containing products that can be used in soybean this year. That situation is very likely to change for next year, so make sure you pay attention to information coming out from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture there. But with the outbreak of soybean aphid this year, I think a lot of farmers and agricultural professionals were relieved to have access to chlorpyrifos-containing products. I know quite a few people that have been using them, and they still seem to be providing very good control of soybean aphid infestations. The pyrethroid insecticides, they were very commonly used and an important part of soybean aphid management, but that's that group to which we've documented soybean aphid resistance over, you know, a number of years now and across a broad geography across much of Minnesota and into some of the neighboring states as well. And I've heard reports of people this year, you know, some people have tried using pyrethroid insecticides and they've gotten lucky where they've happened to have susceptible aphids in their fields and those pyrethroids worked fine. But other people have had problems where they've decided to use a pyrethroid and it's has not worked. So, you know, I do not recommend using the products with just a single pyrethroid, and that's solely based on the fact that we know there are pyrethroid-resistant aphids out there, and we can't tell right now which fields have them and which fields don't. So to me, it's too big of a gamble. So then going beyond that, you know, we've got some of the newer products like Transform and Savanto that are in that same group with the neonicotinoids. They're separate subgroups within that. And then there's the group 9 insecticide Safina. And that acts a little bit different than some of these other insecticides. And the main thing to remember with Safina is that it kills the aphids more slowly than some of the other insecticides. It'll stop them from feeding very quickly. So the aphids will stop feeding, but they're going to kind of linger on those plants for a little while, basically waiting to die from starvation or desiccation, maybe falling off the plants. One of my students who was doing some research on these called them like little zombie aphids that were on the plants after treatment. But what you got to keep in mind is that these aphids that have been treated with Safina, they're not feeding anymore. And an aphid that's not feeding is as good as a dead aphid. So we've got options available now because of some of these newer insecticides. And then you mentioned mixtures, Dave, and that's where it gets pretty complicated, I think. And I don't know how close of attention people are paying when we start using these different mixtures. You know, you get situations where you can have a product with a mixture of, you know, maybe two different pyrethroids. And, you know, I guess I would encourage people to think about that. You know, what are you gaining by having those two different pyrethroids in there when the aphids might already have resistance to the pyrethroids? There's mixtures with pyrethroids and neonicotinoids and pyrethroids with like the Safina or the Transform. Some of these newer, more aphid-specific chemicals are even being mixed with pyrethroids now. And, you know, the other day, Dave, you and I were talking about some of this, and you know, to me, I'm not sure how good of a fit that really is for Minnesota soybean pest management, because soybean aphids are the main pest of concern in Minnesota soybean. And we know we've got some of these products, Safina and Transform, that do a good job on aphids. So I personally don't really see the value in adding the broad spectrum pyrethroid to that for aphid management. And I think it's kind of twofold. First, you know, we're not really going to gain much in aphid control by having the pyrethroid there, because the Safina alone or the Transform alone will do a pretty good job controlling those aphids. And, you know, now you're, by making that mixture, you're suddenly going from a product that will do a good job killing aphids but leaving the natural enemies alive to having a product that's going to, again, act like a broad spectrum insecticide because that pyrethroid is mixed in there. You know, so not only will it kill the aphids, it'll now kill the natural enemies.
And that was my point, is the benefits of some of these single mode of action might be better if you're concerned about the beneficials in not clouding the landscape, so to speak, mm-hmm. with a mixture where you can't really maybe protect them as well in terms of that, because that's you know, one of the selling points of some of these are the fact that they were, quote, easier, kinder on that beneficial population.
That's right. When it's just that one mode of action, that's aphid specific. Some of the, you know, one of the main benefits of these mixtures would be if you've got a field that's infested with multiple pests, mm-hmm. right? You know, I think that's where you can get the benefits from that. There is some possibility for, you know, utilizing mixtures in resistance management, but that gets pretty nuanced and it's kind of a fine line to walk, I think. And in the situation with a lot of these mixtures that we've been talking about, it's a pyrethroid that's mixed in with something. And again, we know a lot of our soybean aphids have resistance to the pyrethroids. So that's just one more reason why they don't make a whole lot of sense to me, because you're kind of going in, I like to say, half broken with these mixtures, because the aphids already might have resistance to that pyrethroid. So you're not going to be getting as much control from that. And then, you know, are we creating a situation where we might be selecting for more resistance that way?
Okay. Well, we're closing in on the end of our time here. Bob, any last thoughts that you have in terms of overall soybean aphid management, looking in the future here in terms of that? What are some things that, you know, you can do if you aren't in a position or choose not to use, obviously, an insecticide product? Any other comments or just anything in general?
Yeah, I think just kind of getting back to the scouting and treatment decisions, you know, for this year, typically we recommend that threshold of 250 aphids per plant through the R5 growth stage. Once we get into the R6 growth stage, you know, especially kind of early R6.
That's full seed.
Yep. There has been documentation of some yield loss there, but we feel that it takes a lot more aphids to cause that yield loss. We don't have a research-based threshold for that growth stage yet, but if you've got a very large infestation in that early R6, sometimes it probably makes sense or would make sense to spray those. But if you're scouting the field regularly and using the threshold of 250 aphids per plant, hopefully you'll be able to prevent yourself from getting into a situation where you've got a large infestation in R6 and it gets a lot more complicated to make those decisions at that point. You know, other than that, Dave, you know, after all these years of, you know, researchers and farmers and everyone dealing with soybean aphid, kind of sadly, you know, our management really still relies largely on insecticides. You know, we've got a lot of research that shows that aphid resistant soybean varieties with the rag genes, mm-hmm. you know, there's research showing that those can be very effective. And especially if you've got multiple rag genes in individual soybean lines, but those are not widely available right now. I think in Minnesota, it's kind of mainly for the organic niche market for those rag contained or the soybean lines with the rag genes. That rag stands for resistance to aphis glycines, the scientific name of the soybean aphid. You know, so hopefully over time, those will become more widely available so we can get more toward true integrated pest management where we're integrating multiple management tactics. You know, insecticides are probably going to remain one of the tools, but if we can integrate, you know, pest resistant varieties and other things, you know, we talked about biological control, which is, you know, the use of these natural enemies, you know, so thinking about how we're managing the fields to, you know, make sure we can let those insects help us out when they can.
So, well, very good. Now, if folks want to read a little bit more about this, the University of Minnesota Extension, we put out, it's called Minnesota Crop News. And there was an article recently, I think on the 13th of August, that came out on considerations for soybean aphid management. And Bob, you were one of the authors on there. So folks can go on and search for that. Considerations for soybean aphid management, University of Minnesota Crop News. And it's very comprehensive and it'll give you a good opportunity for that. So we'd like to thank Bob, Dr. Cook, for stopping in here to the studio, visiting with us here on University of Minnesota Cropcast. We appreciate your time, Bob. Thank you very much. And we will look forward to finding out a little bit more about research and so forth as we go forward here with the continuing episodes of Minnesota Cropcast. I've been your host, University of Minnesota Extension Educator in Field Crops, Dave Nicolai, and we'll look forward to visiting with you next time. Thank you very much for tuning in.